Well, thanks. It's great to be with you and to be back into this weird and wonderful book of Ecclesiastes. As Sandy said, we started a little while ago, and Ecclesiastes is one of those books that Bible scholars call the wisdom books, one of those parts of the Bible that don't rely on tradition or on authority, but are interested in what we might call empiricism, in investigating the world as it is, in poking and prodding it and just seeing what happens and observing the outcome, so much like much of the work that you and I do. And he wants to, as I say, as we saw then, to teach us to live wisely in a world that is like this and not that, and so on. He kind of wants us to get under behind the source code, or to lift up the bonnet on the car and see it all working. But as he does so, not as a kind of mainstream wisdom teacher like Proverbs, but as a kind of minority report, as the kind of guy with the black clothes on at the back of the room, who's wanting to say the difficult things, who's wanting to notice just how monotonous life is, the patterns of work and rest and creation and destruction. And he wants us to go there. I think it's a bit like training at altitude, that he wants to ask the question or do the experiment that if you can live wisely in all the mundaneness of life, and if you can live wisely even when life does not make sense, then maybe we've got somewhere if we've understood what life is like at the extremes. And the teacher has this repeated phrase, which is the kind of conclusion that he comes to, or the chief observation that he has about life in the world. 37 times in the book he says, Hevel, Hevel, it's all Hevel. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless, or better, vaporous, vaporous. The whole world and every experience is vaporous. That is, it's kind of enigmatic. It's hard to hold on to. It's not clear at the end of any given experience or project what you have to show for it. That's his kind of observation, but he doesn't just want to give that to you on authority. He wants to take you through the great experiment that he does with his own life as he tries to test his thesis in many and different ways. And he begins his experiment, and that's the passage that you've got printed for you. He begins his experiment to see whether everything is vaporous by testing pleasure. He asks himself, what is life like? Is my thesis true if I live for pleasure? And you'd think that's a fairly brave and noble experiment to put yourself on, to think, here we go, I'm going to test pleasure, and is anyone available for this experiment? And he kind of says, I am, I'll give it a shot. And so off he goes bravely, doing things that no ethics committee would ever let you do. Firstly, he tests it with drinking. So in verse 3, he says, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. Or in verse 4, he moves from drinking to career and achievement. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. He tried career and projects. He also tried power. In verse 7, he said, I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. He tried the pleasure of telling other people what to do. And he tried the pleasures of wealth. In verse 7, I own more herds and flocks than anyone else in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasures of kings and provinces. And in verse 8, last but not least, he tries sex. He says, I acquired male and female singers and a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. And then in verse 9, he sums it all up with fame. I became by far greater than anyone in Jerusalem before me. You get the picture, right? This brave teacher in the service of humanity, enduring one bout of pleasure after another, just so he can come back and report to us on what he experienced. He was certainly thorough. He says in verse 10, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused myself no pleasure. And what was the conclusion of his hard work in this area? In verse 11 of chapter 2, he says, when I surveyed all the work my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was vapor. Everything was a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. The interesting thing about Ecclesiastes and the kind of minority report status that this book has is that it's not at all moralistic. That is, he doesn't come to you and tell you about all the moral failings that his adventure took him on, although they were true. And he doesn't tell you about all the outcome failures, the kind of utilitarian maths of how many people were hurt in the process or what happened to those who were part of his experiment, although that would be true as well. The book focuses neither on the morality or on the outcomes, but on his key observation that it was all insubstantial, that it was all vaporous. Now, the moral thing is true and the outcome thing is true, but this book wants to particularly focus us on the fleeting nature of pleasure, on the way that pleasure, like everything else, says the teacher, is like the kind of condensation that comes out of your mouth on a winter's morning, where it's there and it's real, but you don't own it at the end. You don't possess anything having looked for meaning in life in that way. That's his observation. He says that I pursued pleasure. I thought to myself, is pleasure something that is not vaporous? And his conclusion is it is. Pleasure is transitory. It's empty. That's its nature. And I'm going to put it out there and take a gamble. And gamble on the fact that we already knew that. That in some sense, you and I know that to be true. The Harvard professor Robert Nozick did a famous experiment. It's had different permutations in different times. It's a thought experiment, so we can do it now. It's called the experience machine. You might have come across a version of this before. So Nozick would ask the subjects of his experiment, imagine that you could plug yourself into a machine that somehow brought you into an alternate experience of reality, and you could be whatever it is you wanted to be, the most pleasurable and achieving version of you, so that you're a surfer in your 20s and you're a great careerist in your 30s and you're president of the United States in your 40s and whatever it is you want to be, that's you, and it is completely real. Once you're plugged in, you have no idea that you're in a machine. You just absolutely experience life like that. You can choose to live to 100 and die eating marshmallows or however it is, just the most pleasurable experience possible. Got it? You don't know you're in it once you've chosen to be in it. And his simple question was, would you choose that over your life now? And the surprising result he found, not always, but overwhelmingly, is that most people would not choose the experience machine. Even though that would give you overwhelming pleasure, it would make your life one of unrelenting pleasure, most people would prefer the authenticity of the life they have now to the unreality of the experience machine. And I think we know that's true, that there's something about pleasure that's so pleasurable, of course, but at the same time, it's not the place where we find fulfillment. You know, that the kind of the pleasure of experience, or the pleasure of wealth, of possessions, that, you know, that little thrill you get when you first own a new thing, and you at first you kind of think with the iPad or whatever, this changes everything, and I'll never kind of be unhappy again. In fact, just on the way here, I was looking for a mirror because I'd just eaten something and I was worried about my teeth, and so I couldn't see a mirror, but I thought I'd just check on my iPhone, and so there I am walking through Perth looking at a digital photograph of myself checking for teeth. And if my grandma doesn't even understand that you can do that, but to explain to her that that's how I checked my teeth on the way to a meeting in the city would just be extraordinary. And for me, it was unremarkable, except that I had to come to you and talk to you about it right now. These little jumps of pleasure from the things we possess never last, like a drug addict needing a bigger and bigger hit just to get a decreased result. In the film, the Spike Jonze film, Where the Wild Things Are, the take on the famous children's book, Douglas, one of the monsters, asked the King Max, the kid, who's elected king of the monsters, he says, will it be your policy to keep out all the sadness? And Max says he has a sadness shield that's big enough to keep out the sadness for everyone. And I think Australians vote with their feet and think that the possession of the new thing will be like a sadness shield that keeps out all the sadness, and it just doesn't. And so, as Clive Hamilton has described Australians, as people who spend money they don't have to buy goods they don't need to impress people they don't like. Or as Manning Clark, the great Australian historian, once described us Australians as bored survivors in a kingdom of nothingness, boozing and surfing at Bondi, waiting for the barbarians to come. The funny thing about pleasure is that almost none of us mentally subscribe to that as the fulfilling life. And yet the vast majority of us live as if it's so. The pleasure religion is a religion that has very few believers, but thousands of practitioners. So what do you do with that? Well, what do you do with this observation from this book of the Bible, that pleasure, that the pursuit of pleasure is not itself the way to find fulfillment? What if, as Judith, one of the monsters in The Wild Things, where The Wild Things are, what if she's right when she says that happiness is not always the best way to be happy? Well, I've got three observations for you before you head back to work from this book. The first one, from the teacher to us for some wisdom, is that it's possible that in our pursuit of life and of pleasure, we're too focused on gain and too inattentive to process. One of the great observations of this book is that life is better experienced as gift rather than possession. And it's possible, maybe likely, that you and I are crushing authentic joy in our lives by treating pleasure as a possession rather than a gift. Sounds kind of strange and new age. I'll show it to you in verse 10. He says, "My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for my toil." My heart took delight in all my labour, and this was the reward for my toil. The teacher says that in his experience of looking and thinking, do I possess anything at the end? He says, no, you don't possess anything. But he says there was a reward in the process, that it was possible to take delight in the things of the moment when he received them as a gift. Let me illustrate this in a really homely way. About once a week, as it works in my house, I do a big clean of the house. Susan, my wife, does the small cleans on the way through. I do the big one about once a week. And so every week I'm there doing the floors and the bathrooms. I'm kind of specialising in those areas. And the house looks amazing by the end of it, after this big kind of three-hour surge of work. And then we've got four kids, under six and under, and it takes, you know, minutes before the cracks start to appear. And then, you know, if you do it in the day, by the end of the day, you wonder why you bothered, because it's almost unrecognisably, it's just back to where it was from. And I think the teacher would say, well, of course you're going to be miserable if you're always looking at the outcome, if you're thinking, what have I got to show for this thing? And the teacher would say to you, and in your own, it would say to you and to me, don't worry about the gain. Think about the process, that, you know, you got to clean a house, and at the end, for a small time, it was clean and that was good. And you got to work on a report, and maybe that report will be forgotten in 3 years, and maybe that project won't get pulled off by next year, and maybe the funding will come out of your department. And it's miserable if you think about all the things that don't happen. And the teacher says maybe there is wisdom in being involved in that process, in receiving the gift of the moment, that now I get to write a report, and now I get to eat lunch, and now I get to have this conversation and clean this house, and so on. So maybe we're too focused on gain and not attentive enough to process. Secondly, maybe we're looking for pleasure in all the wrong places. Maybe we're looking for pleasure in all the wrong places. I remember a few years ago, the art critic Robert Hughes did this great series on three great architects, and the middle one, which was his favourite, was Gaudi. I don't know if anyone's been to Barcelona, where most of Gaudi's work is, and I haven't been, I've just seen the photographs and so on, but it's just extraordinary, this incredible kind of organic architecture with not a sharp surface on any of them. It looks like it's just grown out of the ground, and it's just extraordinary. And Robert Hughes, the art critic, clearly loves Gaudi above all else. He's far and away his favourite. He's just eloquent and emotional as he describes the architectural work of this great man. And at one point in the documentary, there's this great moment where Robert Hughes interviews an old Spanish man who lives in one of Gaudi's apartments, And it's great because he's not the little Spanish man isn't a critic or anything. He's just a guy who lives in the apartment, and he talks to Robert Hughes, and Robert Hughes says, what's it like living here? And he says, yeah, it's great, it's beautiful. And there's showed him a few things about, hey, if you pull this door, another lever opens that thing over there, and the kind of whimsy of Gaudi's work and so on. And Robert Hughes said again at the end, he says, so are you enjoying life here? And the guy said, look, actually, no, my wife died last year, and I don't like it here anymore. It just reminds me of her. And it was just this extraordinary moment in the documentary where this guy who got to live in the most beautiful apartment of the most beautiful architect in one of the most beautiful cities in the world was not happy because his wife had died. And I think that's something that we know as well, that somehow in the quest for meaning and significance and fulfillment, we know that it's not in pleasure but in relationships. That you would sooner be in a shed with someone that loved you than in the art gallery with someone who hated everything you stood for. And I think that intuition is right, that relationships, rather than pleasure for its own end, are at the heart of the universe. And finally, as we finish and open up for questions, I want to ask where maybe pleasure, which is so unfulfilling as an end, is maybe pointing us beyond itself to something else. This was the suggestion of the great atheist turned Christian C.S. Lewis. He called it the quest for joy. And his observation was that joy, that there was something that pushed humans on, which was a quest for something that was never fulfilled in any given experience of pleasure. He says it this way. This is quoting C.S. Lewis. I saw in all my waitings and watchings for joy, all my vain hopes to find something, something of which I could lay my fingers on and say, this is it. I noticed that had been futile. To use the Ecclesiastes word, it had been vaporous. It was an attempt to contemplate the enjoyed. All images and sensations, if idolatrously mistaken for joy itself, soon honestly confess themselves inadequate. All said, in the last resort, they say to us, it's not I. I'm only a reminder. Look, look, what do I remind you of? And I wanted to put it to us that it's possible that those moments of fleeting pleasure and true joy, that when you try to grasp them and own them, just slip through your fingers. Maybe they're saying to us, it's not me. Look, look at what I'm pointing to. Look at the joy that is possible in knowing the God who made you. It's interesting, in one of the great stories of Jesus in the New Testament, he says that the kingdom of God, that is the man who finds Jesus, is like someone who finds a field and discovers that in the field is treasure buried. And so he goes off, and the Bible says, in his joy he sells everything he has to buy the field. It's a great little story, because if you look at the guy from the outside, you would think of him as anything but a pleasure seeker, because he's just downsizing and downgrading his investments and selling off his assets and all that kind of thing. And you'd look at him and think, this guy is kind of a Puritan or some kind of pleasure denier. But actually, it's in his joy that he gets rid of everything else so that he can own the treasure. And Christianity is fueled by that kind of joy. And you've only met the God of the Bible when you realise that the joy in him is worth getting rid of anything and everything else for.